Well, thank you, Phil. A great presentation. I really enjoyed yours. I do have questions. Hopefully you don't disappear at the break. So I look forward to talking with you further. I'm an administrator, a research administrator for Cotton Incorporated. And so I look at things a little bit differently than scientists. We ask why we're going to do research. Why do we invest? The people that I report to are about 200 growers on the various Cotton Incorporated board and the cotton board. And so they want me to tell them why I'm suggesting major research efforts to them. And one of the ones that I'm going to talk about today is low fertilizer cotton, it's pretty obvious some of the reasons why we want to move that way, why we want to invest in that research. Obviously, fertilizer is a huge part of the energy input for cotton. You can see on dry land, it's over half. On irrigated, it's about a third. So it's a huge amount of the energy input, but also it's a huge amount of the dollar input, about the cost. We know what happened 2 years ago when supply and demand squeezes on fertilizer. Obviously, energy goes up, and that impacts the ammonia cost tremendously, but also supply and demand of phosphate in potash as we compete with grain crops around the world trying to add added yield for those. But we also have to look at it from a broader standpoint too, and from an environmental or sustainability. This is a very nice summary that came out in September of this year in Nature, looking at acceptable limits from a global standpoint. And even though the article didn't mention it, it used a green zone analogy from Iraq, which was I thought was very germane. You can see that fertilizer is considered the second most concern that's off the limit, so to speak. Biodiversity, obviously, way out there in terms of species that are being lost versus new species that are being created. But nitrogen and to a limited degree phosphate, we're way off there. And we know about many of these. Obviously, nitrate impacts on health and nitrate impacts on the anoxic zone in both estuaries, Chesapeake and in the Gulf. But we're learning more about nitrous oxide and impact on greenhouse gas. The IPCC in the 2007 made an estimation that 1% of the nitrogen applied as agricultural fertilizer goes to nitrous oxide. But also, since the Montreal Protocol has been successful at lowering the CFC content in the air, nitrous oxide has moved into the number one impactor on stratospheric ozone. So it has, and another issue that just keeps getting piled on, is nitrogen, reactive nitrogen in the environment is a major cause of loss of biodiversity. So it's just really, it's a bad actor in a lot of ways. Another reason that farmers get excited about research directions is it may mean more money for them in the future. And again, this was a very nice article in Nature in December. And just look at the data. Don't look at the gray part because that's their forecast. But the part of this graph which is over here, this is the actual data. And what these scientists did is they're very in tuned with the global interest in reducing the carbon content of the carbon emissions of our economy without sacrificing the standards of living that we have. And to do that, obviously, we need a low carbon energy sources. And so these scientists asked the very simple question, what's happened in the past in terms of scale up on energy sources? And so they calculated this area that they called materiality, which is equivalent to 1% of our global energy demand, how long it takes for a energy source to reach materiality from the point of first demonstration. And they show that these lines were very parallel. It took about 30 years to scale up. And those of you that have worked in industry know that the scale up on issues is huge. You just don't take that up for a benchtop and all of a sudden you're supplying 1% of the world's demand. Interesting, the only graph, the only line that's fairly flat is traditional biofuels, that there was this delay here. But once it was kicked back up again, we resumed on that the exact same slope. And so that really tells us we're going to have a difficult time lowering the carbon intensity of our energy. And obviously alternative greenhouse gases such as nitrous oxide and methane, which are substantially more potent than CO2 and with a shorter residence time in the atmosphere, they may have an impact. So at Cotton Incorporated, I like to use the model, the BSF model. We don't do ag research. We hope to make ag research better. And the way we hope to make it better, it's a hope, is by being wise with the funds that the growers allocate to us and that we work with on scientists, but also putting scientific teams together and helping look at directions of research that benefit growers. Also, a big part of what we do is to get growers involved in the research process, get them involved in not only prioritizing, but also reviewing. Juan Landovar held a research meeting, and about five or six growers there, very interested, having those growers participate in the research process from the beginning all the way through the evaluation, I think is very important. So we don't do the research. Here's where the research is done. And these are the real co-authors on this very short paper, the academic institutions across the U.S. that are involved in cotton. As I mentioned, we're eight scientists. We fund about 250 different academic scientists with 403 projects. So a very simple program with these scientists. From a business model, but very complex from the standpoint of the research areas. These scientists put information to the public domain that then feeds into other scientists, consultants, industry, and ideally this information feeds into producers. So let me talk about the low fertilizer cotton as an objective, because not only do growers ask why we're doing something, but they want to know what the outcome's going to be. They want to know, so you're building all this research, what are you going to deliver to us in 5, 10? They don't mind if it takes 20 years, but they want to see a direction. So that's where I need your help, and you'll see this paper is really more of an RFP than it is anything else. And so obviously a huge amount of research has been done on making fertilizer more efficient. And I'm not going to talk at all about some of these issues here. I'm going to focus more on the areas that are ongoing in research, but I really want to keep in our mind the BHAG, the big hairy audacious goal that actually Bob Nichols wouldn't let me put the word zero fertilizer out there because he thought that was just way too audacious. But the small print is on some part of every farm or every field. That'd be a great BHAG to have out there. So if we look at the research which you all are doing in this area, and much of this is being presented in special symposiums today, the fertilization of modern cultivars at low densities, small seeded cultivars, germplasm screening for fiber, oil, and protein ratios, and one that you probably don't know that we're funding research is biotech modification of seed protein content in cotton. So just a couple slides on that. That's with Kent Chapman, who did this research published in Crop Science last year, looking at a transgene that lowered the oil and protein content. This is trait divided by control. A little bit of reduction in total seed weight. No impact on boll weight. little bit of an increase in fiber yield. But the really exciting thing was that the pounds of fertilizer per bale that was hauled off by that reduction of seed protein, pretty nice reductions in fertilizer that's hauled off the field in that protein. And some of you will ask, well, why is the phosphate and the potassium, why is that down substantially? In protein bodies, that's where the phytate is resides in the seed, and the counterion for phytate is actually potassium. So you lower the protein bodies. Here's a wild type, and then here's transgenic, and here's severe transgenic. You lower the protein bodies, and you impact N, P, and K. But you can imagine, in addition to lowering the N, P, and K, what you do for germination. And these things have to be transplanted to do any field studies with them, or even very, very difficult to deal with. So currently we're putting a gene switch into these. It's an alcohol gene switch to try to go after some of the seed storage proteins, in addition to the other gene that's been looked at previously. I think this gene switch, once it's put, it's in cotton now. I think that's going to be very valuable for the research community. Those of you familiar with gene switches know they're used as genetic models a lot, and so hopefully this will get picked up a little bit. Let me show you some of the other research that is ongoing. Obviously, our production system is evolving constantly, and so looking at mineral nutrition and fiber quality, impacts of bugs and nitrogen management, carbon credits, I mentioned that earlier. If something does come out from a legislative standpoint, we want to make sure that cotton has the data to defensibly say that we deserve some of that money. So we're working on developing data. Cover crop, effluents, nitrogen picks, fertilizer availability by depth. There's been a lot of work which is ongoing. A large component of the effort that the public sector scientists are doing is looking at precision applications of fertilizer in response to NDVI sensors and COPMAN. And there's a special session in this area, a variable rate nitrogen based on soil nutrient and drip irrigation fertilization as we heard earlier today. So let me just close with really, and this is more of an RFP. I wanted to give you a little summary of what's ongoing, but we need clever ideas. And so I really ask you for to reach into your toolkit and to think of this as a BHAG, and we welcome your clever ideas to try to build this pyramid and for both economic, environmental, and sustainability reasons. Let's see what we can do in terms of clever ideas to lower our total fertilizer input. With that, I'm going to give you a few more minutes back, Phil. Do you have time for a question?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, Dr. Pettigrew?
Yeah, Taylor, with your transgenic cotton line that Kent Chapman has done there where you lowered the seed protein.
And oil, yes. Yes, and in fact, that's why the work's being redone with a foliar gene switch trigger. This is a strategy that a grower could make the decision if he wanted to lower the protein himself in the field. So depending upon where he would end up putting that cotton, he would make that decision himself. So this is a strategy that is not done pre-season like some of the previous strategies. This would be done in season by the grower. And obviously, in other crops, you can trade off, you know, protein and oil and carbohydrate. You know, there may be some of that is available too. But this would be a grower-driven decision. Thank you, Stu. Any other questions? Yes.
Not a question, but a comment, Cater. I know it's not your bailiwick, but if you'll work with your people in Cotton Incorporated, get the price of cotton up to about 8 cents a pound, I'll quit using so much fertilizer.
I bet if we had cotton at 80 cents a pound, you'd want to pay even more for fertilizer. No? With that, that is definitely everyone's objective. So we love high-priced cotton. Yes, Juan? Well, I think clearly efficiency is a part of the way that we lower. But I think from an environmental standpoint, I think that if you look at this is a that's a pretty alarming story, and this is in Nature. So this is mainstream science that that they're saying that reactive nitrogen is a threat. And I think with the cotton rotations that we have, cotton has the opportunity to solve some of the threats that really come from corn or other crops. I would like to lower that total bill if possible. But that's a good question, Juan.
Thank you.
Thank you.